here we are at Health 2.0, the conference that takes place in Santa Clara every year. This is the ninth year, and I'm amazed we made it here at all, David, given the football game going on outside.
I know, crazy traffic, crazy action in the hotel lobby with all these people with the cheese heads because we're playing the Packers.
It's pretty easy to tell who's at the conference because they would have the iPhones on their heads.
Definitely a different demographics, it seems.
So every year at Health 2.0, Indy Subbaya and Matthew Holt bring together everyone on Earth who's interested in digital health. And these days, that is a lot of people, all of whom are gathered here in Santa Clara, to see what their best friends and enemies are doing in the space.
This is Tectonics, the podcast focused on the people and passion at the intersection of technology and health. I'm David Shaywitz.
And I'm Lisa Soonan.
This guy goes to a psychiatrist and says, "Doc, my brother's crazy. He thinks he's a chicken." And the doctor says, "Well, why don't you turn him in?" And the guy says, "I would, but I need the eggs."
Well, that's such a great clip. You know, you have to admit that this whole digital health thing has gone crazy. And it seems that the crazier it's gotten, the more cynical Matthew's gotten about it. And of course, you need the eggs.
Well, we seem to have a lot of egg production going on. In fact, I was just laughing about this with Michael Milnson, who's talking to me this year. I decided to import for my keynote because we always struggle with our keynotes, and we'll joke about that later. But I decided to import somebody else to give half of mine. And Michael Milnson actually has a cartoon from Ernest Amory Codman, the guy who invented transparency in 1913 at Mass General Hospital. I kid you not.
He invented transparency.
And he was very offended by the lack of interest in his desire to make surgeons transparent. Imagine that.
Yeah.
In 1913. Shocking. Shocking. And he actually drew a cartoon, which we're going to show, of his other surgeons as ostriches with their heads in the sand laying golden eggs. So there you go. So I can get you back to Abe and to Annie Hall.
I love it. So, Indu, you guys started this conference together 9 years ago when the whole digital health scene would have fit pretty much in the palm of your hand, not in the massive convention center. Did you foresee it becoming so big that you'd end up with Chelsea Clinton and Vivek Murthy on the stage with you?
Absolutely not. And I think we joke and we say that when we threw the first Health 2.0 conference, it was supposed to be a dinner party for like 50 of our friends that we thought were doing something cool. And Matthew at the time was like this, you know, came up with the radical idea of doing it in a hotel. And maybe we'll just have a room for 150 people in case that dinner party gets a little bit bigger than anticipated. But we were shocked with the 500 people that showed up. And Lisa, you know, you were there. It was a surprise to all of us. And I think the evolution to today just remains a surprise every year.
How did you guys start working with each other?
Well, the way I like to talk about it, there are about five stories, right? So the one which Indu won't let me tell is when she showed up late to a talk I was giving, which actually is true. And I found out later that this is pre-Uber, right? Because she'd been waiting. She went out to the East Bay where I was giving a talk to the Northern California Hymns.
I like how there's
chapter.
Like the world before Uber and the world
pre-Uber.
Being a good environmentalist, she takes Bard out there and discovers that the hotel that we're going to is like 4 miles from the Bard station. Jeez. There's no cab, right? So anyway, I have no idea if that's true. But that's how I make up. So she walks in the room, and this is actually the genius of Indu Subbaya. She walks in the room, and I'm upstage talking, and I've just come to my slide saying, "This is what Web 2.0 is." And this is the Northern California Hymns Group in 2006. So, you know, cutting edge, maybe. all right. And
cutting edge for 1950.
Well, anyway. And so I say to the room, "Who knows what Web 2.0 is?" We've been around for about a year or two by then. Tim O'Reilly had been talking about it. And, and then Indu walks in. I've met her once. And I said, "Indu." And she goes, "What the hell? I just walked in the room. Somebody's calling me out." I said, "What's Web 2.0? And she goes, this like beautiful explanation of what Web 2.0 is to the whole crowd. And I thought, wow, she's pretty smart. I should talk to her afterwards. So we talked to her afterwards. And actually, we drove back together. I think I gave you a ride back so you didn't have to use Bard again.
Right. Matthew and I originally met at Bar Camp. Remember Bar Camp? It was one of the first meetups.
No, I don't remember that.
You weren't trendy enough.
Invited.
You weren't that trendy. It was a high bar, right?
It was the original meetup. And it was people who would get together on weekends and geek out in San Francisco. And
I think I was having a life then, maybe.
Yeah. Luckily, you two got rid of that.
And I'd graduated from medical school and moved to San Francisco in 2000, which at the time, kind of leaving clinical medicine, was not as cool as it is today. Now kids who go to Stanford, they're like, "Well, of course I'm going to go get an MBA and then go to MIT and do my postdoc." And, you know, that was just not what people did back then. And so I was a little bit of a black sheep moving out to San Francisco at that time. But I was pretty determined to be an entrepreneur. And in my journey as an entrepreneur, I was an entrepreneur in residence at Physic Ventures. I was in consulting at the time. I kind of found Matthew because of the healthcare blog, and I was like, okay, so this guy is kind of blogging about this space and beginning to talk about what I'm seeing as an opportunity as an entrepreneur. I wasn't going to go start a health conference company, for God's sakes. I was going to go start a tech company in the space that was going to be bigger than Google,
You did start a tech company.
And I might still, and I might still go back to that. But my point is, I found him at this bar camp, and the name of that, I don't know if you remember this, was something like Web 2.0 meets healthcare. And it was people who wanted to talk about these terms together, and we show up and we start talking. And I'm like, oh, that's the guy that writes the healthcare blog. And that's how we then continued. And it was on that drive back from that funny Northern California Hymns meeting that Matthew was talking about that we hatched the idea. And we said, well, I said, you're writing about this space. I want to build something in this space. Maybe we should gather the people.
I remember that blog being the first blog I ever heard of being a blog in healthcare.
He was doing it way before.
Yeah, you Johnny-come-lately bloggers, I don't know. So, by the way, the greatest business move. So Indu basically calls me up and says, congratulations, you're in business. We booked a room at the Hilton, more or less. And the greatest business move was, I think we booked like one of those rooms that had like two adjoining rooms. And you could take the air, who knew, you could take the air wall down. Mm. And we started selling tickets, you know, just off the blog, over PayPal. A certain amount of chaos for that first year, to be fair. We're much more professional now. And, you know, then like we sold enough that we said, oh, my God, the room is full. And the Hilton said, don't worry, there's no one next door. We'll just take the air wall down. And that was business expansion 101.
So now you guys have expanded all over the world. I mean, you've got conferences in Japan and Europe. And, you know, you got people here from Finland. What the hell? And, you know, in Holland and all sorts of places. What's the thing you've noticed as you've taken it worldwide? I mean, what's the difference and the similarities? And how does that play into the whole thing?
So I would say the similarities are the leading thing, which is, you know, not I'm a big Thomas Friedman fan, but the earth is flat, right? The world is flat. And if you're a smart kid in Slovenia, South Africa, Sao Paulo, some town in Asia beginning with S, I'm running out. You know, technology is technology. And the other thing that's true about healthcare is that the healthcare problems are healthcare systems are very different, but the problems are basically the same, right? And the major problems are twofold. One, issues. Problems get opportunities. One is that consumers,
I was patients, very consultant-y.
Yeah,
it
was good.
Nice.
Either way, beat me up for being. I used to be a consultant once. there are two things I've always thought about. One is you've got consumers getting smart about healthcare because of technology. Mm. That's the web and all the stuff we've been talking about for now 20 plus years. And the other one is that everywhere you go, the connection between sort of consumers' primary care and acute care, where they do expensive stuff, is completely broken and screwed up everywhere. And there's no connection. It's true here. It's true in the UK, where they've had the same system forever. And so those two things are the same. And that the tools, the smart kids with the new tools everywhere, are basically attacking those two problems.
Yeah, and I think each region around the world has its sort of areas of focus, right? So when we were in Korea, which was really fun to launch Health 2.0 Asia there this past April, aging was a big topic, of course, in Japan as well. So you've got East Asia really wondering about how to deal with this aging population. So what are the ways you stay well? How do we collect data? How do we provide services to this population?
I'm writing this down because I need to know the answers.
And longevity.
They discussed it. They may not have had an answer, right?
And by the way, countries within Asia compete on longevity. And, you know, who's got the best longevity and things like that. So I think that's sort of that area that it's an issue that comes up. In places like China, it's about access. It's about, you know, how this type of technology can really deliver care to remote areas. In India, surprisingly, it's hospitals jumping on board and really figuring out how to be honest, how to make money. This is a growing sector in India, that the sort of for-profit care delivery system. So I think we're going to hear a lot more there.
In theory, you'd think that having all of these different people from all around the world with their slightly different take on things and having everyone together such as they are at your conferences, you'd like to think that, oh, some of these, and you hear about, you know, with IDEO, that these ideas from one country and how one group of people approach something could then be applied more broadly. Are there an example you can think of from one of these other countries that you're thinking of where an idea that originated there found traction somewhere else?
That's a good question. I find that, so, you know, there are companies in India right now that are doing, if you will, like MyFitnessPal, but for like the Indian diet, you know, because you can't really, you know, track calories in the same way for certain. So,
but how is that not like a Pandora for cats, you know? Like,
right. I'm actually finding the opposite.
Pandora for curry.
I thought that it would be.
Not for cows.
I actually think the opposite. I actually think that I am surprised at how regionalized some of this stuff is getting. Huh. I would have thought, well, it wouldn't match to Matthew's point, technology. This is just going to go cross-border and everyone's going to sell everywhere. I think because people are entrepreneurs everywhere, someone's going, there's Sermo in the United States. I'm going to do Sermo for Japan. And I'm not, you know, and in fact, they did. And that's the mm-hmm. first digital health company that went public on the Tokyo Stock Exchange is Medpeer.
I heard a story just like that the other day. I was in Munich and there was a company that talked about their platform for rehabilitating stroke patients online kind of thing. And I said, well, there's one like this that I'm familiar with in the U.S. And he said, yeah, they can have the U.S. We're going to take Europe.
That's right.
You know, it's quite amazing, I think, that the regionalization, you're right.
But, you know, when you think about collaboration, the opportunities to sort of to drive innovation, you know, one of the issues, even for some of these, is, you know, even when they have these collaboration contests, one of the issues is once you sort of have a model or a solution that's perceived to work, everyone sort of can incrementally improve it. There's sort of this MATLAB example. But the issue is that sort of in a theoretical way, you wind up at like a local maximum. You wind up people tending to improve that specific idea and not necessarily looking more broadly for an orthogonal way of solving that same problem. Is there a risk that if people latch onto something that may or may not be a great idea, whether it's Sermo, whether it's MyFitnessPal, whether something like that, that everyone tries to do it globally and you wind up with sort of a copy of something that may or may not be great in the beginning, versus really trying to solve an important problem in a truly orthogonal way?
I don't think I worry about that so much in this space. I think because I think people are always bringing sort of some customer viewpoint to bear, some sort of pain point to bear, that I think they are going to approach it uniquely for their own market. So, like, for example, in the Middle East, you know, which does not have yet a robust indigenous digital health scene, you know, they're talking about really specific issues, like, can women bring up health issues on their own with their providers? So they need communities and environments that are safe for people to voice health concerns. So they are going orthogonal. Fine, they're aware of patients like me. They're like, online communities exist, but they're narrowing the focus and they're specializing these in such creative ways to allow it to be safe spaces for certain communities. So I think they are approaching it orthogonally.
Yeah, I think there are two things going on, right? One is that I'm a believer now that having started doing international healthcare policy in 1990 when I showed up in the States, you know, I thought everything was totally different and I would know about America and never have anything that could be transferred anywhere outside the U.S., which is why I had to stay here and why you all have to put up with me.
I thought it was because your soccer team keeps losing.
They started winning years after I left the country and losing again this weekend now.
Coincidence? I think not.
Maybe. No, the big coincidence is that when I got here was the exact start of the microbrewery revolution.
Oh,
it was the tipping point.
That could be it.
My contribution to the market.
Nicely done.
Anyway, I was talking about something more substantial there and you put me off again.
Foreign policy,
right. So, you know, we used to say these things are very different. I think they're actually roughly, there are things you have to do that are different on the edges, but it's still the same problem we have to crack. Now, two things going on. One is there's way more money here, both in terms of venture capital in Silicon Valley still, thanks to people like you, Lisa, but also in terms of just money in the healthcare system. And it's so much of one bigger market, the U.S. So what you're seeing with the Finns, the Dutch, the Brits, I had some Scottish people in my office wanting to do it there.
And if it's not Scottish, it's crap.
Something like that. They all want to grow the Silicon Valley of their own at home, and they want to bring the Finns are really outspoken of this. They're open to tech is, you know, they have all the sort of ex-Nokia folks. They do investment and all the rest of it, and they want to bring them here, and they want to find markets for those people here.
Right.
And then we've got companies like Bedit and Nuna and others who are going to be here doing, you know, exactly that. And they see they're in a market of 5 million people. They see a market of 330 million people, and they just need to translate it and do it better and quicker and get part of that. So I don't think that it's illogical to see that kind of stuff happening. I also don't think that you necessarily are going to see dramatically different solutions, but, you know, there is localized, customized product in any market you look at, even if it's like things like Coke, right?
So if you look at the trends in digital health over the last year or two, you know, the stuff that's been, everybody talks about, pick your topic. What's the most underrated trend, the most underrated opportunity that nobody's, or not enough people are thinking about? And what's the most overrated? What are you like, oh, geez, if I see another, you know, whatever, I'd kill myself.
I So I think underrated. The concept of non-invasive diagnostic testing, maybe that's rated just fine, but I think we could go on and on about the power of the locus of control of diagnosis shifting from centralized environments with heavy and expensive equipment to the hands of patients anywhere. And I think that we can't be talking about enough, and we're going to be going into this a little bit at the start of the conference tomorrow, where we're talking about diagnosis now not just being about cheaper hardware, but about algorithmic, you know, diagnostics, so the AI aspect of it, the sort of parity and the equivalence of these diagnostic tests to the traditional ones they're being compared to. So they're not being sort of cheap proxies, but actual full replacements. So to me, that's something that's...
What's an example of that where it's really proved to be adequately robust?
So the company that's called Smart Vision Labs, for example, who now people, they raised $6 million, so people know about them, but they first debuted at Health 2.0 as this young team that won a competition that we had. And this is, you know, measuring vision with the iPhone. And everyone thought, well, that's a nice supplement, but it's fully replacing that giant thing in the optometrist's office that, you know, goes, is this better, is that better? And they're handing out glasses at the point of care in the field in developing countries, right? That's just one example, all the way from that to like a Theranos of the world, which we're all more familiar with. So I think that category of what used to be take a picture of your skin and a doctor's going to diagnose your condition, that's going all the way to like, you know, that's gone to like a consumer thing that Best Buy, you can buy the actual, you know, skin diagnostic camera, not just your iPhone picture. So that transition, I think, is really
interesting. But that's really happened. Yeah. I mean, it was, I kind yeah. of, but in terms of your, there's an out there, I mean, I'm aware of algorithms and companies that talk forever about, oh, theoretically, and there are some companies in the diagnostics space, Veracyte, I think, is an example where yeah. they do thyroid biopsy. If it's someone has an indeterminate biopsy, they're able to sort of evaluate it better than a human pathologist.
Yeah.
But I didn't realize that there were that many examples for clinical medicine where there are companies and tests that have been validated to
yes.
be.
Yes. So one company I was challenging, and I'll challenge them on stage, you know, Lisa will appreciate this because she's tough on everyone. He said to me, you can cough into this into the phone as I tell you if you have pneumonia. I'm like, bullshit. Right. Show me the clinical study. And he sent it to me. And the sensitivity and specificity is over 90%. Now, maybe we have to go deeper and figure out exactly
more than seven
who.
Patients,
yeah,
whatever,
exactly.
Yeah.
Fine. I'm a former and recovering, you know, a statistician and a scientist here. So I feel like, fine. So they're off a little. Maybe it's not a perfect study. But that is now the frontier. You know, and it was shocking to me. So this is the sound of a cough.
Yeah, it's yeah. like, you know, there's this company, Eco Diagnostics. Have you guys seen that one?
They just sent me the stethoscope.
Yeah, the stethoscope. And right. the thing that's interesting, it's a digital stethoscope. But I think what's interesting is not so much the digital stethoscope, because there's several of those, but that they're actually trying to create like a Shazam of heart sounds.
Yeah.
yeah.
So you can identify the sound into a diagnostic. And I think it's quite interesting.
They,
you know?
They sent me one. I held it to my chest. I couldn't hear anything. So I must be either heartless or dead. You take it.
You have to have a host organ for it to work.
I want to go to your underrated. I mean, you can argue back and forth, David, and you can argue back and forth about how real the diagnostics are. That's coming to me. That's the sort of the Mark Cuban argument that everyone's going to get their diagnostics checked and will be, and that's mm-hmm. going to get consumerized. I think that's coming pretty quickly, whether or not you like it. The question to me, the big one, is sort of the sleeper is treatment, automated treatment, especially in psychiatry, but also in other areas. You know, think about self-adjusting heart treatments for people who've got, you know, the sort of the Hugo Campos idea. You've got something in you which is a pacemaker, and can you adjust it yourself somehow? Right. Can you take a medication to adjust based on, you know, there's companies like PhysIQ who are working, you know, by tracking people off immediately after discharge using an iRhythm patch and doing algorithms. I think that algorithmic treatment is kind of like the self-driving car. We're not necessarily going to a robot to treat you immediately and be automated, but all the things that have come in that sort of algorithmically support the sort of the equivalent of the, you know, beeping at you when you're out of your lane, I think we're going to notice that that's going to be much more prevalent in 5-8
years. There's a lot of money now that is being raised for companies that do behavioral health. I mean,
sure.
People see that as being a massive opportunity. Are there specific examples, and I know I sort of keep focusing on sort of the real, which I think you'd appreciate particularly because you're, both of you, I guess, do a very good job of calling out bullshit, as we've seen just now. But examples for behavioral health of where someone has an approach that's really been validated in a way that here's a group of patients and they really are going to have a behavioral health intervention that you might say that can really either replace or augment, I imagine, a psychologist or a psychiatrist?
I'm going to start with this. Go on. So, you know, I mean, obviously, right from here, you know, Ginger.io has been doing this stuff for a while, they now are sort of changing their model, so to speak. But I do think about them being one of the players here. I think they published a paper on the number of missed calls on your phone can correlate to your risk for suicide. I thought that was fascinating.
Guess it depends on who the call is from.
Right, exactly. Yeah.
No, but do you think Ginger, I mean, just to, again, push, sorry, but to push that a little bit. So I love the folks at Ginger.io. I've actually profiled their technology and a bunch of stuff I've written because of the promise of it. But in terms of at the end of the day, it is different. You wonder how much of it is, they do all this stuff, and oh, by the way, they do a validated behavior rating scale that you actually fill in, mm-hmm. as if it's just sort of like a, you know, like an e-device for a, are you, you know, back depression?
Yeah,
yeah, yeah. So I can't see Ginger.io. I see Ginger.io sort of supplementing and provide. I see the theory of why it should be such a great company, but I'm not sure when you think of the people, who have psychiatric illness. Are you going to prescribe them Ginger.io and say, you know, good luck with that?
Right. I mean, I think now the challenge for them will be they were direct to provider. They were a B2B company. They've gone B2C now. So I think it'll be interesting what features of their, you know, platform actually make sense in the real world. I think for me, when I think of Ginger.io, I still go back to the concept of passive data collection.
Absolutely.
And to me, that, fine. Maybe it's off a bit here and there, but... One other thing I'll say about mental health, though, and then Matthew, I'm sure, has a bunch of other examples to add, is I was really taken by the folks in Europe this year who showed the kind of virtual reality environments mm-hmm. for people with panic disorder mm-hmm. and phobias. And I know family members, you know, that can't fly, and this is real for a lot of people.
Oh, that's interesting.
And these are now mm-hmm. pretty sophisticated environments backed up by clinical data that are treating these conditions. And so I tried one on. You know, it's a little bit weird still. It's a little bulky. Other virtual reality environments had to do with touching and feeling if you actually don't have sense in your hand. So gloves that you can then feel warmth and fire. So imagine an older person living at home that may be losing sensitivity in their limbs and may go near a hot flame or, you know, hot water. So I think
But they're going to be protected because they're wearing, like, the helm of Thorin or
a
something.
It's a glove that actually somehow transmits a feeling in a different way. But I think these virtual environments and with Ellie, the facial reading robot, there's something about how
Ellie, the facial reading robot.
She's facial reading, not flesh eating. Can I just
Same difference.
Pretty close. But
so what do you think about overrated? Right, what's overrated, though?
I hate to push you on this. I know you're reluctant.
You guys can push what you like. But I'm going to say bullshit to the medical system, right? This is my conversation with Michael Millinson, and I've actually had to cut most of my stuff out. But frankly, if you look across the whole healthcare system...
Is all you were going to say is bullshit?
No.
He would agree with you for the most part.
If you look across the medical system, right, we do all these things in it which we know don't work, which you know are wasteful, and they get put on even half the randomized clinical trials, which we go through. So we've had, back in the day, patients like me did their clinical trial looking at the use of, was it lithium to
ALS.
To deal with ALS, or was it Parkinson's? One of those two. And they showed that you could use their study to disprove a regular, you know, clinical trial very quickly. We know that many clinical trials, I mean, there's the all trials issue, are either hidden or not done properly, or we know that they're biased depending on who the funder was, you know. And we know that stuff gets into practice completely random. I mean, the best story about stuff getting into practice is the thing I studied in my Stanford thesis, which was laparoscopic cholecystectomy, which somehow came up this morning from Joe Flora, that I should get one. Anyway, but I don't know why. But here's the story, right? This was a new procedure for doing gallbladder removals, right? It used to be an open thing. It was invented by somebody in France. An American surgeon called Eddie Joe Riddick discovered it, started using a laparoscope, started charging, could do them quicker for the same CPT code, so he could charge, you know, more, run more people through. The patients were out of hospital quicker. It was all great. There was no studies about this stuff. He did a few studies, but it wasn't like they did the COURAGE clinical trial on stents, which, by the way, showed that you shouldn't use stents, and we still use them, by the way. But the joke is, my favorite line about this is the guy, he started teaching other general surgeons how to do this. for like a couple of grand a throw. They could stand behind him and watch him as he did it on the computer. And he made so much money in 2 years, he retired and became a country and western singer. So that's how we do medical, you know, that's how we spread medical technology in America now. And, you know, okay, early 90s.
But the result is that it's worse for people to have lap collies? No, it's great for people to have lap collies. Okay. Versus an open.
But it was, what was the point? It was perceived to be better, right?
Yes.
It's perceived to be better because it seemed to be
faster,
better for the patients.
Faster, quicker, cheaper.
Faster, quicker, cheaper technology without going through the study. Why do you want to use a different standard for patients like me or ginger ale or something like that? I understand we should be paying attention to that and we should be doing trials and the rest of it. But you've got to accept that there are some things which look like the right thing to do. And I think that's how this stuff will sell and will spread.
So what about overrated? I'm trying to get back to
He's
make
trying
a say
to get
it.
To overrated.
I'm trying to
drones.
Drones for
I
health.
I don't know. Care. Everybody's telling me this is it. That's it. It's drones for health. It's the biggest thing. Okay. I mean, maybe.
What are they going to deliver?
They're going to deliver
new
gallbladders? Medication in the middle of, you know, a busy
hopefully bring a
city.
Pizza with us.
So yeah. You hear about for natural disasters, right?
Yeah.
Right. That's what you
not
hear.
Not overrated, but oversaturated is now telehealth. Right, mm-hmm. So I think
sure.
You've got four or five established market leaders. You've got American Well, you've got NB Live, you've got Teladoc and Doctors
right.
on Demand who are well-funded. And you're starting to see stuff pick up there rapidly. It's hard to imagine, that, and I'm still seeing people come to us with like new telehealth companies
yeah.
all the time. You're going to see a growing market, but you've already got some of those relationships with the big payers and with the big plans and providers kind of locked up. So that's that to me is you know, is a really, I think it's great. I do them. I'm a user, but I'm not sure that...
I have to laugh because my daughter called me from college last week and she said, you know, I've got this problem. I need to see a doctor. And I said, well, why don't you just call, you know, one of these Teladoc type deals and you know, we'll get you help. And she goes, who does that? I was like, everybody? I don't know. So what about companies? Like what company is coming to Health 2.0 or is involved in the digital health field that you thought you'd never see? Like, what the hell are they doing here?
Xerox is going to be on my panel on community health. What's Xerox doing in community health? They just bought the Healthy Communities Institute.
Right.
Huh. And they're really interested in the social determinants of health because they think aggregating all of this, you know, EMR and claims data kind of only gets you so far. And even with user-generated content, great. But really, it's kind of public health data, data, you know, locked up in kind of sort of county health departments. I think that's fascinating. So I'm going to really be pushing our friend there on that. I think there's another little company coming to us from South Africa that I'm really excited about on the data panel called LifeQ. They're doing optical sensors and new physiologic models for the body, looking at everything from kind of cortisol release during times of stress so that you can distinguish that Fitbit spike of heart rate for exercise versus stress. You know what I mean? They look the same.
That's
on
good.
Fitbit
we'll have every
right
species
now.
Biomarker in the on the same platform. That's great.
So my answer to that is a bit different, right? So who shouldn't be here but is here? So we have All Scripts.
I love you, Matthew.
All Scripts and Avelity, right? Two companies who are traditionally old world companies who figured out that they need this community, right? And they're opening up their API. And so we're going to have a really cool thing where Lumiata, Ash Damley, I don't know if you've had him on the show yet, but his company is going to work with Allscripts to basically take data out of the EMR, do some fun stuff to it, do some interesting analysis.
And figure out what they're not going to cover.
And figure out, maybe that, but also hopefully figure out what diagnosis
we're
gonna is being
missed. We're going to tweet what we're not covering now.
Yeah, what diagnosis is being missed and all the rest of it. So I think the thing that we have to add is who needs to look at the developer and the innovator community and be here? And there are also people who you wouldn't expect to be here. But, you know, we've had old crusty people think you wouldn't be here coming for a while. We've had my friend Kaiser Permanente, been here since the early days. And this year we have the American Medical Association coming.
I know.
Wow.
So, you know, we're
have the Imperial March when they march in.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I mean, but you should see Steve Stack, the president, talk about the current state of EMRs. He's not he could be politer. He's polite, but he's pointed.
So yeah. You guys are futurists, healthcare futurists. You've called yourselves. What's going to happen in 10 years? What's the big...
Who called us that?
He's a futurist.
I gave up being a futurist.
I
quit
being a futurist.
I'm barely a presentist.
So what do you think? So look out 10 years. What's the one thing that'll happen that nobody is really thinking right now?
So I come back to, you know, everybody loves to hate on wearables and, you know, to your point about specious biomarkers. I don't know. I mean,
that sounds like a great name for a band.
Well, I'm a huge believer in dynamic phenotype, but I just feel like there's a lot of overhyping.
You know, it's because it's still early days. And I wear, you know, a Fitbit and I look at, you know, the state of this. It's not that hard to imagine this getting a lot better pretty fast.
And a big opportunity to improve.
Fine. You know, but so I think that that's, to me, if you take that out to its logical extension, you are talking about new models of the human body. I think you're talking about radically sort of teaching medicine as a field in reverse from like what actually is. And I think there are things we simply don't know about how the way the body works. I think these will help us kind of rebuild that model. So to me, that's...
I actually share that vision entirely. So yeah, I love that. Yeah.
I'm going to say something radical. I think in 10 years, we will actually be able to access all our healthcare data.
All the healthcare data.
All your healthcare data in 10 years, you'll actually be able to get it. I'm seeing enough stuff where the data's moving back and forth. It's kind of cranking there, and there will be services to do it. And
maybe all those people who are making, you know, get your data, their movement, what are they going to do in 10 years?
Give me my damn data.
Well,
give your data back.
E-patient Dave will be on the beach somewhere, and Fozeb will be, you know, in a bow tie manufacturing facility. I mean, who knows? But the point is that need for that movement, I think, will go away, and we're going to see a lot of stuff at Health Tip in the next.
Do you have any view of unicorns or butterflies or any other?
The unicorns are all usually on Lisa's toenails.
So nice to have you guys here. I hope you have an amazing conference. I'm looking forward to being part of it. And it's great to have you on the show today.
Delightful.
Thank you.
Thanks so much, guys.
Oh, there's that groovy music. Now it's time to get in the flow. Whoa. Tectonics is coming to an end. This is it's been great spending time with you. And thank you so much for tuning in here to our live broadcast from Health 2.0 Conference in Santa Clara. If you like this podcast, you can hear more of it by looking on my blog at venturevalkyrie.com.
You can also find us on iTunes. Also, check out my blogs at forbes.com.
Thank you for listening.
Achaim, baby.